From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The city of Wilmington and New Hanover County recently approved a financial incentive package worth $580,000 for National Gypsum. The Cape Fear region is competing with Tampa for the company's business. This morning, WHQR's Vince Winkle spoke with Nancy Spurlock, Director of Communications for National Gypsum. They say they haven't made a decision yet, but say they are very close with an announcement planned within the next few weeks. If National Gypsum chooses Wilmington, it would reopen an existing plant that stopped manufacturing when the recession hit. It would commit to a $25 million investment in the facility and the creation of at least 50 jobs with an average salary of close to $58,000. Some local residents protested the approval of incentives for a company that will emit formaldehyde as a byproduct. National Gypsum officials say the plant will emit far less than its permit allows, and they've agreed to additional stack testing. For those reasons, local elected officials say they're satisfied the company will be a good corporate citizen. But National Gypsum isn't the first company to spark controversy over its plans to locate in southeastern North Carolina. Today, we'll explore the local reaction to incentives and how new definitions of incentives, such as quality of life, infrastructure, and educational resources, are gaining prominence as economic growth strategies evolve. With us to explore these questions, Adam Jones. He's an associate professor of economics at the Cameron School of Business at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He's also the regional economist at UNCW's Swain Center, a research center specializing in executive education and economic development. Adam Jones, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Good to have you back. And I'm very glad to welcome back to the program Tim Buckland, senior government and politics reporter for the Wilmington Star News. Tim Buckland, welcome.
Hi, Rachel. Sometimes I wish my title was as long as something like Adams.
We can work on that. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. How effective do you think incentives are when it comes to attracting business? Is it necessary for economic development? Is it corporate welfare? If you're a business owner, why did you open up shop in southeastern North Carolina? You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or at coastline at whqr.org. Adam Jones, when we're talking about incentives, we're often throwing around very different ideas that wind up in the same basket that we call incentives. Can you briefly explain kind of the range of forms that incentives can take?
Sure. And incentives can take a lot of different forms. When we use the term in Wilmington, talking about incentives, it's most often referring to grants or a cash payment to a company to undertake some behavior, usually locating in this area. But incentives can take a lot of other forms. I mean, there are historic preservation tax credits, which is an incentive to preserve an old building. Investment in infrastructure to help support a new shopping center that's coming would be an incentive for them. Declaring a shopping center or a site as a brownfield site to help with remediating environmental damage is a form of an incentive. So the list is almost endless. In many other states, the incentives, when they talk about incentives, it's not a cash payment to a company, it's a reduction in their taxes. So it's achieving the same objective, just a different way.
Tim Buckland, what form are the National Gypsum incentives going to take? Assuming that that actually happens.
They're going to take the form of cash payments, just checks sent to the company after it meets certain benchmarks over a five-year period. The benchmarks include hiring 51 people at an average salary of, I believe the number is 50,000 or more, and investing $25 million in their new plant to refurbish it. If the company doesn't do it, they don't get the money. And there are examples in the past of the city and county not making cash payments when a company didn't meet its obligation. AAI Pharma was an example. They were offered an incentive package if they expanded and hired more people. The company didn't end up going forward with those business plans, and the county hasn't made its payments. When the county and city offer incentive package, you have to meet certain criteria in order to get that money.
And in this case, we're talking about a $25 million investment, a certain number of jobs with a certain average salary level, nearly $58,000. And you recently published a piece on the growth of certain sectors, the workforce, taking a look at how the workforce is growing here in the Cape Fear region. And what did you identify as actually some of the easiest areas where people can find jobs?
Well, I quoted the guy sitting next to me as saying a big sector is leisure and hospitality. It's growing faster than probably anything else in the region, as you know, we're on one of the prettiest places in the country. So naturally, people want to relax and have a good time here, and someone needs to bring them that drink and make their hotel bed. And so that's why that sector is exploding. Unfortunately, and I'll let Adam go from here, about the salary levels of some of these jobs.
Oh, you're going to let me deliver that
news? Yeah, let you be the bearer of bad news.
Regional economist Adam Jones.
So the problem with employment in the leisure and hospitality sectors, it doesn't tend to pay well. Some jobs do, but an average annual wage for a job in that sector is about $17,000 or $18,000, which doesn't go very far in Wilmington. Some of the other sectors, such as, and why they get a lot of attention, is manufacturing, for example. So manufacturing in Wilmington, the average annual wage is almost $80,000 a year, which is well above the national average, and it reflects the quality of the manufacturers here. So a GE and a Corning are not the sort of dirty manufacturing that we used to think about, but it's high-tech engineers, high-skill type jobs. So, but those are also the hardest jobs to bring to town because every city and county in the country is competing for those jobs, and one way you compete for those is to try and make your package look as attractive as possible. Incentives are part of that.
One of the criticisms that I've heard about an average salary as a benchmark is that you can have upper management with very high salaries and then have a lot of jobs that are lower wage jobs. How does that factor into this national gypsum question? I mean, do we know? What does average salary mean?
That's a great question that I'm not sure I have a good answer for. You're right. An outsized salary or two can skew in average. I don't think that's as large of a concern for the National Gypsum facility because most of their executives are not going to be at this facility. So I think these are probably reasonably good numbers to use to think about how the employees will be compensated. And I would also argue that there's more to it than just salary. So we have a tendency to talk about that. But full-time employment with benefits is very, very different from close to full-time employment without benefits, but at a similar salary.
Tim Buckland of the Star News.
We asked that question of National Gypsum because when we write about things, we prefer the number median because that gives you, in my view, a better view. Because, for example, when you talk about home sales, three houses sell, two of them for $100,000 and a third one for $58 million. Well, the average sale price for this neighborhood is $20-something million dollars. So we asked that question. I mean, is this how close to reality is the average? And what they told us is that they anticipate a minimum salary for the workers to be at around $50,000. So they said they hope to exceed that average number, but they negotiated that as the benchmark for their incentives. So that's why that number appears.
Adam Jones with UNCW, one of the points that you've made about the process of attracting companies to a region is that that company's reception, public reception in the region, is a factor. Local stakeholders organized a Stop Titan movement in 2008 that ultimately dissuaded Titan, a cement manufacturer, from opening up shop in New Hanover County. It was a passionate, well-organized effort that lasted 8 years before Titan said, we're not going to do this here. Why do you think, in that case, Titan lasted 8 long years? Is that kind of a typical case study or not?
From my experience in local economic development many years ago, that's being incredibly patient or persistent, depending on how you want to look at it. Most companies would have moved on much quicker than that. However, if you're trying to figure out how to service a customer base in the southeastern U.S. and you're looking at a limited number of sites, you may be more persistent in trying to go into a location. But companies with flexibility on where they go, it may not even be 8 years. It may not even be an 8-minute phone call that they see something in the newspaper and cross us off the list. I like to think of this a little bit as sort of a relationship between the companies and the community. And there's an economics piece to it, and there's also an emotional piece. And it's the emotional piece that a lot of companies won't necessarily push through because they'll just say, well, we'll go look somewhere else.
Whatever you think about incentives and their efficacy in the conversation, there always comes out this kind of sentiment that they are necessary because other municipalities and other states play the game. And that means that everyone has to play the game. Is that really true? Is it a given that a municipality, if they decided to get out of the incentive game, they'd always lose? Tim Buckland.
What's the last movie that filmed here in Wilmington? And how is Sleepy Hollow doing with its filming in Georgia right now?
And we'll talk more about film incentives when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline. We're unpacking how corporate incentives work. We'll take a closer look at why it's so difficult to track their quantity and impact sometimes. We've got UNCW regional economist Adam Jones, Star News senior government and politics reporter Tim Buckland. And when we come back from this break, we'll take some of your questions. What do you think about the efficacy of corporate incentives? You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or at coastline at whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. As local and state governments pursue targeted economic development strategies, financial incentives for companies continue to be a source of controversy. We're taking a closer look at why, and we'll also take a look at what we do know about their effectiveness. With us today, UNCW's regional economist Adam Jones and Star News senior government and politics reporter Tim Buckland. They're answering your questions on this Thursday. If you're a business owner, tell us why you decided to locate in the Cape Fear region. You can reach us either via email at coastline@whqr.org or by phone at 910-343-1138. And Tim Buckland, just before we went to break, you held up film incentives as an indicator of incentives working, and when they're removed, suddenly there went the business. That's kind of a unique industry because, unlike a manufacturing facility, film production companies move. That's what they do. They're mobile units. But how has that affected the Cape Fear region?
Well, you make a good point about them being mobile, because if you remember when Iron Man 3 was filmed here, all of those scenes from them falling out of the sky, they were done here, and then they later superimposed images of Miami. So they filmed here instead of in Miami because they, you know, had incentives to do so. So what happened was it was cooking along, and people who live and work and represent this region were saying, yay, film incentives. We're Hollywood of the East. And then it was changed, and it was turned into a grant-based program with a limited budget, and it dried up. And the evidence is there that something like a film production will go where they think they get the best deal.
And what kind of ancillary effects have we seen on the Cape Fear region? I mean, I'm not sure that there's actually been a study done yet to determine the post-tax rebate film incentive effects, but, you know, we've heard anecdotally about a florist closing or this business moving to Atlanta.
Well, I mean, I don't know about all of the small mom-and-pop effects. studies have found both that film incentives had a net return to the state, and using the same numbers, another group will say that we've been losing money on the dollar. So I don't know which study we'll call more accurate. All I know is I haven't seen a huge film production here in a couple of years. We've had some television productions, but our film reporter will tell you it's nothing to the scale that it was 4 years ago.
Adam Jones of UNCW. Why was this incentive, first of all, not so appealing to state legislators as the tax rebate that it was?
I think there are several important pieces to think about with that. One, it's not necessarily appealing to the state to have an incentive that is difficult to forecast. So in a tax rebate, they're not sure how expensive it will be each year. A second reason it wasn't as appealing is because the majority of those incentive dollars flowed into the Wilmington region, disproportionately so. So you think there are 100 counties in North Carolina and 75 or 80 of them never saw a film production, so they're not going to support the incentive. And the third one is it was a really, really big program. So a 25% rebate on your operational expenses, if you were to take that and apply it to the National Gypsum Project, so you figure they've got 51 employees they committed to at $57,000 a year, and if you say that's their only operational expenses, you're talking about $750,000 a year that we would be giving them under an equivalent incentive program to the one that we had for films. So it was a very, very large incentive and reason for films to be here. So
when we look at incentives from a state point of view, recently the state went after Toyota. And I think the incentive package that they put together for Toyota, which would have included, according to NPR member station WFAE in Charlotte, would have received more than $656 million in corporate tax breaks, $54 million in sales tax exemptions for the materials to build the facility, $100,000 to run what's been dubbed the Japanese Saturday School, a place where children of Japanese managers would be taught their native tongue. Toyota ultimately chose, as we know, Alabama, but the story asserts if you add up all of that money, that comes to about $1.6 billion. Why was the state willing to do that? Is it just because it was predictable and this ostensibly would have been in a different part of the state, not impacting all of the, you know, the 99 other counties?
Well, one of the reasons that you chase large projects like that is to try and develop the foundation for a cluster of businesses around it. So if the Toyota headquarters comes to an area, then you're much more competitive to try and attract the headquarters of their suppliers or a regional headquarters or a production facility. And it's a story about trying to get cluster development and synergies within the community and across firms.
Yeah, and let's not forget a politician's favorite word, jobs. You get to hang your hat on that. A couple thousand jobs opened up here under my watch.
Well, so you can make that argument with the film industry.
Sure. And several of our local politicians do make that argument.
Right.
So I
guess what I'm asking is if you can make the case, you know, to Raleigh legislators who from all the counties for a $1.6 billion incentive package in a certain part of the state for Toyota, why didn't the argument about the film industry fly in Raleigh?
I don't think the film industry has the same sort of geographic reach that a Toyota headquarters would. So if Amazon headquarters locates in Raleigh or Charlotte, that puts the state on the map and all the rest of us in contention for support facilities, as opposed to if there's filming production going on in Raleigh, that doesn't necessarily generate as much activity in other areas of the state.
Another point that this story from WFAE made was that nearly $1.6 billion in incentives would be enough to fund either the current budget for North Carolina's Department of Environmental Quality for a little more than 22 years, repave more than 14,000 miles of highway, or buy nearly 52,000 brand new top of the line Toyota Priuses. But Adam Jones, you take issue with that comparison. Why?
Well, part of it is you've got to think of this incentive as an investment into the future and a stream of income that will come off of that project if you land that project. So take the National Gypsum Project here, for example. The same argument came up when we're talking about the incentives for National Gypsum. Well, we could use this to focus on homeless programs or feeding the hungry programs. And while those are noble causes, if we can bring a National Gypsum that spins off tax revenue every year, then you can use that tax revenue to support those programs. It's like investing in an annuity. All of us are saving for retirement, trying to think about how we become financially independent. Well, we should be thinking about that at the community level as well.
You're listening to Coastline. We're taking a closer look at the complexities around corporate incentives. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Adam Jones, regional economist at UNCW Swain Center, an associate professor of economics at the Cameron School of Business, and Tim Buckland, senior government and politics reporter for the Wilmington Star News. Do you think corporate incentives are part of a good and necessary economic development strategy? Tell us about it on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. We're watching the growth of fintech in this area. And first of all, I think we had an entire discussion a week or so ago about the growth of fintech and never defined it. So Tim Buckland, tell us what fintech is for those who aren't familiar with the term.
Well, I'm not that familiar with it. My guess is it's financial tech.
Yes.
But you're referring to operations like nCino and Live Oak Bank, right?
Yes. So, yes, that's right. And
every economic development person throughout this region will point at Live Oak Bank and say, see, it works. They went from handful of employees, 10 years ago, to 400, 500 today. They've got this gorgeous campus just off the intersection of Shipyard and Independence Boulevard. They have a hangar at the airport. They're own corporate plane, you can't argue they're not a success story. And they were offered what is could be argued as a relatively modest financial package from the county and city just to get them an incentive to keep them here instead of moving somewhere else, because they could do this operation anywhere. They don't have to be here. It's another mobile operation. You know, they lend money to small businesses that most banks don't, like veterinarians, breweries, things like that. So they have these particular targets that they lend to, and they could do that from any building they chose.
So what do we know about why they are here?
I don't know why they're here. Do you?
Well, I think that goes back to thinking about the community as a whole and economic development as a package that's being offered. So quality of life is an important part of that. A good potential source of employees is part of that. And I don't want to toot UNCW's horn too much, but there are a lot of UNCW grads working at Live Oak and at nCino. So for them to locate somewhere close to a potential talent source is important. So it's sort of looking at the community as a whole and how do we make it attractive in terms of quality of life, the economics of it, as well as maybe the emotional piece where incentives can play in. So Tim made the point this wasn't an overly large incentive to Live Oak, but as a community, we certainly need to think about our relationship with them and how do we support their efforts. And part of that is stepping up to the plate and showing them that we appreciate them being here, and incentives are one way to do that.
And we've certainly talked about part of the reason that fintech is exploding here is because there's this burgeoning ecosystem around it. There's this community that supports the growth of financial technology. What are examples of other components of that ecosystem? I mean, I guess educational institutions would be not really part of the fintech ecosystem, but it would be a reason for a company to locate here. But what is an ecosystem for a particular sector?
Well, I would think, and obviously as an academic, I'm probably more risk averse than these entrepreneurs, so they can call in and speak to this much more than I can. But I think a big part of that is a community of support and a culture that is supportive of trying new things. So it's an opportunity for these folks to meet different places. So maybe those are events held at the CIE or at Tech Mountain, or it's time spent at one of the craft breweries talking with other folks in the community. Say, hey, that's a cool idea. Go for it. By the way, I know so-and-so over at wherever. Let me introduce you. So it's sort of these public spaces are an important part of that.
A New York Times opinion piece published earlier this week by Nathan Jensen, author of Incentives to Pander, How Politicians Use Corporate Welfare for Political Gain. Jensen writes he recently made a request for details on companies that applied to the Texas Enterprise Fund, a program that provides corporate cash incentives. And he writes, 45 companies challenged my request for their applications. Many of these companies want to hide their proposed jobs and wages on the initial application. It's an extremely effective way of making it impossible to evaluate if these companies keep their promises to create high-paying jobs in exchange for taxpayer dollars. Now, Tim Buckland, you talked earlier during this hour about how AAI Pharma actually didn't meet its benchmarks. That was very clear, and so incentives were not handed over. But how easy is it to get information about some of these private companies?
Luckily, our local governments are relatively honest. For example, I asked for PPD's package from the city of Wilmington. It was emailed to me within a half hour. So we can get them. They're all considered public documents. I don't know why the New York Times ran into such a difficulty in Texas. Maybe they have different sunshine laws. I don't know. What I do know and what fascinates me about this particular topic is that this is one of those rare circumstances where you can call both sides of the argument right. So you've got both liberals and conservatives who will tell you these are terrible. They're corporate welfare. They pick winners and losers. And then you'll have the other side go, sure, in a perfect world, we would eliminate all of them and everybody would compete on a level playing field. But that's not reality, because if we stop offering things, well, you know what? Raleigh will offer a better package. And why would a company choose us over a city that's saying, hey, not only do we have a nice place for you to live and universities around, but guess what? We're going to give you some cash, too, to open up. What stops a company from going elsewhere?
Adam Jones.
I think we also need to, in that vein, recognize the difficult position that our local politicians are in. So if they give an incentive, the community is going to say, you gave them too much, that was a giveaway. And if they offer an incentive or don't offer one and we don't get the project, then the community is going to say, you let that project slip away, you should have done more. So they're in a very, very difficult position on all of these projects.
We have an email from Jamie. She writes, one of the reasons I relocated here from the Northeast was that I heard Wilmington had a sizable film industry. I imagined myself surrounded with creative, interesting people who work in an industry I love. Instead, what I found was a town devoid of film production and focused instead on cutting down virtually every mature tree in the region. Jamie writes, let's not forget that creative, artistic people who work in film tend to be liberal in their views. She writes, to our conservative Republican legislature, there is small incentive in encouraging employment of people who would never vote for them. And Cornelia writes, why did the consistent income from the film industry not count as an income stream that could be used for other programs? Due to the loss of that incentive, approximately 1,000-plus families have moved to Georgia. What are the income tax losses on something like that? Adam Jones.
So I haven't done a study on the North Carolina film industry, but when I was At the Carl Vinson Institute of Government at the University of Georgia, we were asked to do one by one of the state legislators. And we went through and added up all the tax revenues we could possibly find, all the way down to estimated sales taxes resulting from the films there. And it was just shy of equaling the incentive. The problem with the film incentives is they are so large that it's hard to make an economic case for them. I think the case that really supports them is made by your first emailer, and that's a cultural case, that these are artistic people that add to the vibe and the culture of a community. What makes Wilmington a cool place to live is sort of all the other stuff that's going on, right? You want to have art shows and you want to have music, and the film industry and the creative folks involved in that industry help support that piece of the community. And I think that's where the biggest return on film was.
Don Kirkman, Economic Development Director for Carteret County, wrote an opinion piece for the News and Observer about incentives. An interesting idea he proposes, which we've all probably heard before, is bipartisan legislation banning, federal legislation banning incentives. He writes, "Those who support the use of incentives argue persuasively that without them the companies would not come, but what if economic development incentives were legally prohibited? With advocates on the right, maintaining incentives disrupt free markets by unfairly picking winners. Those on the left and right claiming incentives are corporate welfare. Opposition to incentives represents one of the few areas where factions on both ends agree." And when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask you guys about that point of view. Adam Jones, you were shaking your head, so I want to unpack that. You're listening to Coastline. We're taking a closer look at corporate incentives as part of an economic development strategy. Senior government and politics reporter Tim Buckland of the Star News and UNCW regional economist Adam Jones are taking your questions on this Thursday. When we come back from this break, you'll have one more segment to reach us with your question or comment at 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, we're taking a deeper dive into economic development through the use of corporate incentives. Adam Jones is a regional economist at UNCW's Swain Center and an associate professor of economics at the Cameron School of Business. Tim Buckland is a senior government and politics reporter for the Wilmington Star News, and they're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline at whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes to get your question or comment in. Just before we went to break, Adam Jones was telling you about this opinion piece by the Economic Development Director for Carteret County, and he was proposing the idea of federal bipartisan legislation that would ban incentives so that there was a level playing field, and you were just shaking your head. Why do you think that's not a viable idea?
I don't think it's possible to ban incentives. You might be able to ban financial grants or tax abatements, but then we'll just compete another way. So this is, suppose we were to ban including the refrigerator when you sell your house and say you can't do that anymore. Okay, well then we're going to start repainting the homes or putting new bushes in. You're going to compete along a different set of lines. Communities will compete by providing specialized training programs in the schools for industries they're trying to bring, or building infrastructure that goes past their industrial areas. They'll figure out another way to compete. And another point that needs to be made here and really thought about is the use of incentives to try and close inequality gaps. So rural and economically depressed areas tend to use incentives more than the areas that are thriving economically. It's a way for them to overcome some of the hurdles and attract business and employment to town. So the large cities, Raleigh, Charlotte, Wilmington, I would imagine we would all line up to ban incentives. But some of the rural areas that are scrapping and clawing are going to say, wait a minute, we're fighting as hard as we can, and you're about to take one of the tools away from us.
Is that working in this state? For instance, aren't counties organized according to tiers in terms of their level of economic prosperity or otherwise? And the counties that are the most economically distressed are supposed to have some sort of weight given for state-based incentives. Mm-hmm. But I've heard some rural counties say they don't always see the payoff from businesses that get incentives from the state, supposed to benefit the whole state, but they still are left holding the bag.
Well,
Tim Buckland.
Well, to Adam's point, I mean, some counties don't have a large port next door. Some counties don't have an airport within 5 minutes. Some counties don't even have a major interstate highway close by. There's other things other than money that factor into a business decision. And, you know, sometimes if you've got a county with 25,000 people and, you know, three stoplights in it, well, you might not be able to compete with Wilmington, Charlotte, or Raleigh for that 1,000-employee operation.
And we have Sean from Burgaw on the line. Sean, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Yes. By all accounts, the Wells Fargo Golf Tournament was a huge success. I think they estimated brought in more than $50 million to the local economy. And they gave incentives on the city as well as the county. And they really depended on, you know, the Airbnb and the citizens to really participate and help that, you know, be a success. So I just think it's interesting that the convention center cannot book certain size conventions because they don't have the hotel room space and the city's wanting to ban short-term rentals. So I guess it's just interesting how they want to promote and with the incentives, yet they're trying to ban it on the other side of that. I didn't know if the guests could maybe comment on that.
Sure. Tim Buckland, is the city trying to ban short-term rentals? Thanks so much for your call, Sean.
It depends on who you ask.
And you're saying that tongue-in-cheek. They are not. They're trying to,
establish
a policy. Yeah. Yes.
There are some who would like them banned, and there are some who would like it be a free-for-all with no regulation at all. But it's to the caller's first question about hotel space. Well, right now we've had the construction of, I believe, three or four new hotels downtown, including the Embassy Suites attached to the convention center, with more to come. And I think some officials would argue, I think we're meeting our hotel demand. And the convention center has already booked some bigger conventions, including the Sweet Potato Convention that I found out about, which was the first one to use the Embassy Suites. So as far as how short-term rentals plays into economic incentives, I'm lost. So,
and we talked a little bit earlier about tracking public money, and Tim, you said that you've found it fairly easy to find out what you need to find out
Within an hour, the city of Wilmington and New Hanover County sent me exactly how much they paid, how much they agreed to pay over the span. All you have to do is ask, and I'm nobody special. They'll give it to anyone who asks for it. It's a public document.
In Brunswick County, their economic development efforts were housed under the aegis of the county. It's moved around a little bit. Then it became kind of an independent entity that reported to the county. It's gone through a certain number of incarnations. Is that related to information that is public record and the difficulty of keeping some of these negotiations private? Adam Jones?
I'm sure that's part of it, as well as trying to figure out how do you go about your economic development efforts in a way that is independent of politics, but also responsive to the local officials and to the community. And it's always a balancing act there, and they've been trying some different things. But definitely companies that are looking at an area want to maintain secrecy as long as possible. You mentioned earlier that firms in Texas fought the release of their applications and the amount of investment and employment numbers. Well, part of that is if you can see those numbers publicly, their competitors can start to figure out that firm's strategy. What are they thinking? And they want to keep as much of that close to the vest as possible. Many of these projects don't even tell you who they are until after the deal is done or right before it's done. They all have code names, and you know that this is a pharmaceutical company from the Northeast, and it's the local economic developers are sitting around trying to figure out where the accent is from and which company it might be, but it's a guessing game as much as anything else, as they want to maintain anonymity.
Yeah. And if I may, what National Gypsum did when it ran into some of this little bit of controversy was really unusual. So they called the television station, they called the newspaper and said, can we just sit down and talk to you? And they held a community meeting.
Right.
Companies don't do that.
They called us too. It was unusual.
It's very unusual. So,
and the whole idea was to be as transparent as possible about what their plans were, what their impacts might be.
So that it led to some head scratching by me, because I never encountered that before by a corporate entity basically asking the public, ask us any question you want and we'll answer it, which was, I think, a pretty positive move for them. It was a smart move on their part. It helped dispel some of the controversy and some of the follow-up meetings. People, even when they got up to speak against it, they said, well, we do need to say thank you to them for listening to us at least. And I think maybe that's where Titan had their problems, was that they took a combative stance against the community. And so it was just a constant headbutting as opposed to just to answer a couple questions.
But that wasn't until after the National Gypsum project was fairly far along in the process, mm-hmm. and they had gotten to the point where they were negotiating incentives and thinking about the permits. That was after the initial inquiries to the community. I would imagine this project's been in the works for a year, 16 months, and we didn't hear about it, and they kept it off the radar.
And that worked because it was Wilmington Business Development that negotiated this deal, which is not an organization. Tim Buckland, how is Wilmington Business Development funded, and what are its requirements when it comes to?
It gets private funding. A lot of people don't realize that, but at a forum the Star News hosted last night, their director of business development, Billy King, said that roughly 65% to 70% of their funding is from private sources, whether it's memberships or donations. So they do get some money from the city of Wilmington and New Hanover County and Pender County. They contract. That's who handles a lot of the economic development for those three entities. In other places I've seen, it's been a direct government job. There are the economic developers of the world who will tell you that's a lot harder to work in, because I can walk in and say, that's a document on your desk and I want to look at it. Because North Carolina, for example, their sunshine laws are pretty good compared to other states. And if it is a document in somebody's hand, usually that's an open record and I can look at it.
This area was criticized, most notably, I think, in the Gardner report published in 2014, about not having this coordinated economic development strategy. And there were a lot of recommendations that came out of this. It was paid for by New Hanover County. One of the recommendations, as I understood it, was having an economic development department that would be housed by local government, and an economic development director like Carteret County has.
Right. And the idea of that is more direct control, as opposed to farming it out to a private entity and attempting to hold them accountable when you account for only a small portion of their funding. So like anything else in the world, Rachel, there's pluses and minuses to the idea, but it has sat on that shelf and they have not hired an economic development director.
Well, another plus is when you hand this over to a Wilmington Business Development or to a Chamber of Commerce or a private entity like that that's bringing in private funds, is that also means the business community is invested in this. And sometimes they're our best spokesman. They can tell the story of the community as well or better than anybody else. And when they put their money in, they also put their time in. And that's an important buy-in from the community.
According to Michael Mazaroff, a senior fellow with the State Fiscal Project at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, this is part of an NPR collaborative reporting project in Idaho called State Impact. Mazaroff says there's been a great deal of research done on the issue over the years talking about corporate incentives. One thing it's important to understand, he writes, is that even the studies that show incentives can have some impact, some positive impact on job creation or economic growth, the studies conclude it's a very small impact that isn't realized for a very, very long period of time. Does that fit with the research that you're aware of, Adam Jones? What does the research show us over the long term?
That rings true. It's very, very hard to identify the effect of one individual project. So we talk about the film tax credits here going away and the film industry shrinking dramatically. Yet unemployment in this region is very low, in the mid 4% range. So if you just looked at the numbers, you'd say, wait a minute, the film tax credits went away and unemployment went down. So maybe that was a good thing. It's hard to tease out which piece is causing what. It's really difficult to do. I think where incentives can be extremely beneficial is a way to start developing a cluster in your community. So if you have a target industry that you're going to go after, so a potential option for Wilmington and New Hanover County is fintech and trying to support companies that would work with a Live Oak, and how do we take sort of the next step forward in that area? Well, maybe we can use incentives to bring them to town, but estimating the end result of that and whether those were needed or effective, and it's really hard to say.
What about, you know, we've talked about forms of incentives that are non-financial, like the quality of education in an area or beautiful natural resources. What about things like water contamination issues? Do we know, have we heard any stories about companies looking at the headlines? I mean, I don't know how you'd ever track this, Tim Buckland, but even anecdotally, are there stories about people looking at the headlines around Gen X and saying, no thanks?
Well, anecdotally, sure. Has anyone ever called me and said, I'm not locating my business here because we think this is in your water? No. Have members of the economic development community chewed on my ear and said, why does this headline have to be here every day? Yeah, sure. What impact a newspaper story has on a business's decision to locate or not locate, I don't know. National Gypsum still located here, less than a year after Gen X appeared in a headline. So I don't know what impact it actually has.
And you referenced the port that we have here as one of the attractive pieces for certain kinds of industry. You recently wrote about some of the infrastructure improvements that have been made to the port. For folks who haven't been following that, just tell us about that and what it means for the Port of Wilmington.
Oh, it's voluminous. It's a lot. Well over $100 million worth of projects either done or on the way. They widened their turning basin. And for those who need a short primer on what that is, it's the width of the river. So ships of a certain length have to traverse the Cape Fear River for 26 miles to get here. But when they leave, they have to go north a little bit and turn around. So if the river isn't wide enough, then ships of a certain length just simply can't call at the port. So they widen the turning basin so that larger ships can do that 180 degree turn. They're improving a docking berth so it can handle some of these bigger ships. And the most, I guess, visual thing that we've seen was the cranes that came in on the boat that passed Southport, came all the way up the river. And they're just gigantic things that even tower over the current big cranes that they have. And they've got another one coming later this year.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Tim Buckland, Adam Jones, thank you so much for being with us today. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.